Hey, how are you? This is Alex Simmons and Chris Ryan, and you are listening to Tell the Damn Story. I'm Chris Ryan, both independently and traditionally published writer of stories. Yeah. Sometimes crime, sometimes horror, and as of this morning, it's been officially announced, my first Western. Watch out, brothers, watch out. There you go. And with me. Oh, what a guy. Ladies and gentlemen, Alex Simmons. Alex, tell him who you is.
I love that tune. That's just always going to be with me. Hey, Chris.
How's the Temptations, I think.
Yes, I'm exactly psychedelic. I'm Alex Simmons, freelance author, writing coach, writing consultant. I have written comics, plays, film scripts, and a bunch of novels, a bunch of other things. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. But Chris and I are here today on the 265th episode of Tell the Damn Story.
And we look every episode of it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. We'll be back after we take our nap. Anyway, we're here today to talk about an exciting adventure that Brother Chris has been on pretty much solo. So take it away.
Long time. We've talked about it in a lot of previous episodes, and at long last, it is here. Alex could even show it to you if he wants to.
Yeah, hey, I can do that right now. If we're ready for that, I can throw this on the screen.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen, available on Amazon right now. We're going to try and put it on other platforms, but right now, Amazon, Soul Scream Anthologine, the very first volume of it. It's got ratings of 5 stars. Hey, bro. And we're here to talk about how we got that from a notion to reality. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, we're going to do that because, folks, let's face it. This is the world that we live in now and have for several years. It's not just your traditional gatekeepers anymore. Right. You write your heart out and then you take it somewhere and hope they'll publish it. There's a lot of entrepreneurial publishing going on so many levels in so many different genres. And Chris and I have had dabblings and full-fledged battles within those realms. But this is the first time, Chris, that you have taken on this particular type of project. And if I'm not incorrect, developed actually a new sort of life form.
Yeah, I think so. This is the first time I publish other people's works. My publishing imprint, Seamus and Nunzio, went from what people would deride as a vanity press to now a tiny little boutique, tiny little, more like a cart in the
street.
This
is not the Incredible Shrinking Man here, Chris. This is a big project.
We're expanding. We're expanding, and it's a big step forward.
So how did you come up with this new enterprise, this thing called Soul Scream?
Okay, there's 4 parts to that answer. I'm going to try and run through them very quickly. Yeah. Like you, when I was a wee lad, I was a big comic book fan, right? Mm. And especially in the summer. I lived in apartments in the Bronx and the Parkchester section, and there was no AC in those days. So we had this old, fully metal fan that would crawl across the floor, vibrate across the floor, try and eat us. But it would still be really hot. And sometimes it got so hot, all you could do was sit and read. Mm. And there was nothing I loved better than reading like a stack of comics. And in the summer, there were 2 sets of comics that I really loved. And that was Marvel's Giant Size Annuals. And DC's 100-page Spectaculars.
Yes, because even then they were competitors on full intent. Yeah.
Now, the Marvel ones would be maybe 32, 36, maybe 40 pages, but it was all new stuff. Mm. And the DC ones, so you would love that because it was before all the major crossovers. I think the only one that I had seen was the Kree Skrull War and Avengers Defenders at that time. So most of those giant size were self-contained, but really big adventures. And DC's 100-page Spectacular would
100
have
pages.
100 page for 50 cents, baby. You'd go for the giant size Marvels for 35, but it was 50 cents. You'd get 200 pages for a buck.
Yeah.
And there would be like one new story. Like there would be the Justice League would meet the Justice Society. but the rest of those pages would be old Justice Society character reprints from the 40s. And this was before, I think the only comic book store that sold old issues that I knew of back then was Super Snipe Comic Emporium in Manhattan. I'm sure there was others, but I was a kid. What did I know? So you would just pour through those. So that's one thing that influenced me. And then there was Stephen King's Night Shift, which was, I had stumbled into Stephen King, and it was a summer where the whole neighborhood was reading different ones. And for some reason, I started with Firestarter, not his most legendary. But then my buddy Rogers, you got to read Salem's Lot. And my brother said, you got to read The Shining. And then they both talked about The Stand. So, you know, all that was going. But Night Shift,
which was a collection
of short stories.
Yes.
So you could like, huh! And then turn the page and huh! Get scared. It's really cool. And they weren't bucket of blood stories. You know, they would creep you out and stay in your back of your head the next day when you're trying to deliver newspapers. And then later on, around 1970, no, that was in the mid-70s, but in 1988, I think it was, or 89, there was a collection called Prime Evil, which I actually have a copy of right here.
Oh.
Okay. Because Stephen, I wanted to
roll that back up there for our audience who's only listening. Stephen King, Clive Barker, Peter Straub, Whitney Strieber, and Ramsey Campbell. Prime Evil. Whoa.
Plus Thomas Tessier, M. John Harrison, John Cady, Charles L. Grant, Paul Hazel, Dennis Etchison, Thomas Ligotti, and David Morrell, who was just about ready to explode with Rambo. So it was all these people I had never heard of listed on the back, and all these, oh my God. And I hadn't read all of them, but I had heard of all of them.
Mm-hmm. So
you could get that much exposure to different styles. I love that stuff. Fast forward to last Halloween.
So we went from your childhood, hot, steamy summers,
the 80s, and now to, I guess it was 2022. I had been involved with the Horror Writers Association and had accepted volunteering for the secretary as the secretary. And while Glorious and I were wandering around at Barnes & Noble, we saw them organizing an event, and they hadn't done that for a long time. So I talked to the manager of that event and said, I'm involved with the New York chapter of, I think we, oh God, get me as many writers as you could or you can. And I wound up getting, I think there was 10 authors that night, and it was near Halloween, and I'm watching everybody. And one, so, I was surprised.
So this is an event you helped pull together.
I pulled together a Halloween adjacent event of all horror writers reading horror stories at Barnes & Noble. And you know, you could buy the books and all that stuff. Yeah, this one was on Route 17. Sadly, okay. It has since closed. So we're waiting for a newer, smaller version of that store to open up.
Gotcha.
And we'll see. Maybe we can do more things. But one, I was shocked that so many people responded positively and said, yeah, I'll do an event with you. And I enjoyed working with him. So that is what came into play a little later in our story, that I knew people now on a personal level that I might be able to invite to come play.
Now, the only thing here that I got, that you enjoyed all the reading material when you were younger, and then here you are and now a year ago, in a position where you know all these different authors. Where did the idea to produce publication come from? Did it come before you met all these authors or were hanging?
Well, sure, it came from shenanigans that me and you have instigated over the years.
Okay.
You know, I've published, self-published 4 novels and some short stories and that kind of stuff. And after trying for 10 years, I eventually got to write a Blackjack comic strip, and all of the dialogue in that was changed by the creator of Blackjack, Alex Simmons. And it's such a great story because the learning moment there is, yeah, you think you know it, and you're just learning how much you still have to know. But the second part of that story is that eventually you and I did a series called Rapid Reads, and we did novelettes.
Yep.
Four of them and that kind of stuff. And again, that came out of your publishing company. You're independent, I would say. I have experience there. And I had run into Joe R. Lansdale, and he had seen my independent stuff. And Joe, I just wrote an essay about this on Substack. He had just made this offhand comment that this is great, but it's really good to get vetted by somebody. I have someone else publish you and, you know, say, yeah, I'm going to put money behind this guy's story. And that really split my career because he was right. So that's when I started. I think I've been published 13, 14 different times since then.
By other people.
By other people, including you. So right. The blackjack might have been before that or while that was happening.
I found you first.
That's right. That's right. But at the same time, okay, well, I'm not going to throw away the novels I wrote. So during COVID, I worked with an editor and got them up to snuff. And that's the reboot project. Two have come out. Right. One more will come out. And then the other part was going back to Joe's thing, being vetted, having someone say, I'll put money behind you. It's good to get people to say that about me and my work. But then I started realizing there's a way I could serve this community by putting some of my money, not that I roll up the pennies, but by vetting others and saying, yeah, this is stuff that I believe other people should read. Okay. And that led to the next question of, what do you think people should read? And the market is hot right now for splatterpunk and extreme horror. And I respect the people who are doing that. I'm in awe of a few of them. But I try as I might, I can't enjoy it.
Because
the extreme quality of the horror, that just knocks me out of the story.
Okay.
Every single time. It's a quirk of my sensibilities. So I said, if that's really hot right now, and I can't afford to compete with what's getting out there, and it's not my style, maybe I can go in another direction. And there is a market for quiet horror. That sounds like if someone goes, boo, or shows you a pumpkin. That's really not what it is. Quiet horror is a stuff that may not be a bucket of blood, but when you finish the story, it'll stay with you.
Yeah, it has horrific qualities that don't necessarily become visceral.
It might give you something to think about, or it might haunt you. It's that one that keeps you up the next night.
You call it soft R?
That's when I was talking to the authors, then I will talk about that in a minute. Yeah. One of the things I said was, at the very most, it can't go above a soft R. So maybe there's some curses or a little bit of this, but it's not my style to do splatterpunk or extreme horror.
So you had this idea in your head. You had now some resources in terms of writers that you'd connected to. Right. Where'd the title come from?
I started thinking about the kind of things I really miss. Or I don't see as often as I used to. You don't see the Marvel bullpen bulletin with the kind of, hey, here's what's going on behind the scenes kind of thing. You don't have that feel in things that I see anymore. And also, I'm going to show you something.
Okay.
Also, this thing right here. Last summer.
The mic, folks. That's what you're hearing.
Yes. Last summer, I went to StokerCon in Denver, Colorado. And, you know, I had a lot of allergies and a touch of asthma when I was a kid. And Denver's elevation, I couldn't breathe.
Wow.
I just couldn't breathe. And occasionally I would slip out of a panel discussion or reading or something and go up to my room because I was freaking out on how bad it was that I couldn't breathe. I didn't want to make a scene. I didn't want to ask for medical help. It was just, I don't want to embarrass myself. So I just figured if I die in my room,
You know, you pass out in your room. Yeah, it's so really clever there.
When allergies were really bugging me or anything, one of the things that I would do, sit and read. So I sat down, couldn't lay down because I couldn't breathe. Standing, I couldn't breathe. I sat down and I grabbed whatever was around to read. And it turned out to be this.
StokerCon
2022 Souvenir Anthology, edited by Cynthia Paleo, who she won Stokers this year, and 2 weeks ago, last weekend she won. That book saved me again and again because everything in it was captivating.
Mm-hmm.
The interior was designed by Ted Kiesling, and it's beautiful. It's really gorgeous. But the content, from straight conversations from the makers to some fiction, and then author profiles, I was like, oh my God. It was just so absorbing that I really felt like I owed a debt to it. And I wanted to see more of it. So when I started going to pitch people, like I pitched you, here was the pitch. I can't pay you that much. It wound up being, now with an adjustment, it's the HWA minimum. Again, not connected to HWA. I just needed some guideline.
Yeah,
yeah. And publish your story, and then we're going to write a profile after it. And then I started saying, I know a couple of people who do pop culture stuff. So I started asking them. The first issue is I got you and Teal together on a Zoom, and I just asked you to talk about great female heroes of the past who use their will or skill or agency. And that was about all I said in that interview, because the two of you just went, and I think I subheaded all the names of the characters. I think we got somewhere between 10 or 12 or even 14 different. So that's like a mini panel. So with all this different material, I wound up figuring out that what you have with Soul Scream is more than an anthology. It's not quite an anthology. It's not quite a magazine. Put it together. It's an anthologine. And that was a lot of fun. And the tagline is, it's a horror con in your hands. And that's really what the goal is. Much to my surprise, some people have a real problem with me using the word anthologine.
It amuses me. That's a word that you coined, isn't it?
I did, in fact, coin it.
Yeah.
It's been coined by me. Yeah. And it's meant to give a sense of...
It's been coined and minted by you.
That's right. It's meant to give a sense of fun. But some people are like, what's in it? That's an anthology. Oh, you're talking about a magazine. Call it whatever you want. Just come and read it and have some fun. That's really all I want to do, is have some fun.
Folks can get sensitive about the strangest things. Yeah,
it's really weird. The design of this is to... Okay. You can read it and have fun and then feel no guilt at all about handing it off to a nephew or a niece or a neighbor kid. I'd love to be the gateway drug for the next generation of horror fans. That right. would be great.
And they can escalate to splatterpunk or whatever
go
else
wherever you want.
On their own.
Just come on in my gate first.
So I'm going to ask this question. And I, folks, we have a green room. We talk. I already know the answer to this, but I want you to hear the answer to this. This is a big project you decided to take on. So how did you pull together the team?
The team.
Yes.
Well, let me tell you, Alex.
Yeah.
Back in my 20s, when I was working on Bronx Weeklies, I would put my byline on everything I wrote because I was going to the big time. It was what it was. But I'm a little older and a little wiser now. And having 20 things with my byline on there would look really boring. First thing, I had to wrestle with the morality of one of the things I wanted to do. I wanted Soul Scream Anthologine to feature one or two of my characters. So I would allow myself a short story per volume, maybe two in the second one. We'll see. And the obvious choice was Desdemona de la Cruz, who is the keeper of the Soul Scream.
And since folks don't know anything about it, Soul Scream is also a storyline.
Yes, and if you look, if you put the cover up again, you can actually see Desdemona.
Hang on here. I got to go do this now here. Hang on. Where did I put? Ah, here it is. And then hold on. I got to share. Ooh, I almost hit the end this button. That was.
Oh, no. Don't end me.
There we go.
All right. So if you look, the big center figure is a skull. But if you like right where you're pointing, where that is Desdemona de la Cruz. She is the keeper of the Soul Scream.
This thing.
Yeah, and there's an explanation of her origin and all that sort of stuff. So she's in one of the stories. As a matter of fact, I think it's the story called Come Dancing. However, I really loved, do you remember the Marvel Comics, Marvel bullpen bulletins inside the old Marvel Comics?
And for folks who are not as ancient as dust as I am, or as Chris is approaching,
I'm getting pretty dusty.
One of the things that made Marvel sort of just a party, a street party in the comic book world, because you had DC before that, you had Charlton's, you had Harvey, you had all these
other very traditional style.
Right, very traditional. We put out comic books, you read it, that's it. But Marvel developed a community, a sense of you could peek behind the door, you could step through the door into the Marvel bullpen world and hear a Stan and sometimes some of the other players in the thing commenting on the stories or talking, answering letters, everything. It really invited you to hang out with them. And so that was the thing that Chris is talking about and that I enjoyed and so many other people did too. Marvel said, we're all hanging out on the block.
Now I'm going to tie it all together. I had Desdemona in the story and I really like the feel of that kind of Marvel bullpen bulletin, kind of peek behind the curtain. And I said, then I need to hire an assistant editor. Desdemona, one of the problems that she has with these powers that she has gotten through her death, read it, it's worth seeing, is that she is answerable to the Soul Scream whenever it senses a need somewhere. So she gets pulled out of her life all the time, which makes it impossible to hold down a 9-to-5 or to gig. She used to play in a rock band in Brooklyn, but you can't disappear in the middle of a song and still get paid.
Yeah.
So she had a problem. I hired her
because
as the assistant editor. What?
Because you understand.
Because I understand. Yeah. I hired her as the assistant editor. So now we're into meta country. And that opened me up to say that's a way for me to avoid every author profile being written by me. If I can create Desdemona de la Cruz, why don't I create some interns? And it's all on the up and up, because even if it's even in the Indicia page where it says all characters are fiction, living or dead, no real, that kind of stuff, as it, this includes, and I name the interns and Desdemona, so I'm not committing fraud on anybody. But if I'm going to have the interns, I wanted them to reflect different parts of fandom, whether it's reading comics or reading horror or reading crime. So I thought there are three kinds of people that I could start with. And one is the deep diver, that person who wants to talk in deep detail and granular and get down to, that's Finbar McGinnis. When he's writing the author profiles, that's the style you're going to get. Finbar McGinnis is our deep diver. But then sometimes there's those guys who are very pop. You can see him on YouTube talking about the trailer you just saw or the movie you just saw, just endlessly. That guy, they remind me of People Magazine. Hey, just dive across the surface. That's Zebop Maruda. That's that guy. And then there's the true fan, the one who just loves it so much. Real love. And that's Connie Marcello. Just a very earnest, honest pureness to her. And Connie Marcello, the name, the origin of that name, is a play on one of Glorious's first names.
Glorious is his wife, by the way, folks. For those of you who've never listened to an episode before and you don't know this, right?
There was a time when she was a baby that she was or was named or was going to be named Conchantina.
Ah.
And when we found out the kids were in college when this came, this was like a Watergate tape that was released here. I call her by all sorts of versions of Conchantina, and one of them is Connie.
Gotcha.
And her maiden name is Marcello. So Connie Marcello is a bit of a tribute to Glorious. And
there you go.
When she loves something, she loves it with all her heart. So that's where that comes. So you get five different voices that are not authors telling stories.
Because you also, when you write under these character names, you are embodying their persona, their personality.
Yes.
To do the story. And again, we're not talking about him writing fictional stories as these characters. These characters have come to life, work in his office.
Exactly. So it gets another layer of fun, I think.
You're certainly having fun.
And I'm having such a ball.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of, I'm glad to know these characters. And when you read Finbar, you'll never mistake him for Z-Bop. And
good.
Neither
I
of them sound anything
that.
Like Connie. So it's fun, and it allows me to limit myself in as how many times my name shows up. So it becomes a more, it takes on a life of its own.
Just to again emphasize the reality of how you play as you produce also. Let's not forget for a split second here that your security chief is, is what?
If you can see that on some of my social media, you can see the staff photo. That's the Seamus Annunzio Productions Company staff. So
right.
It's myself.
Yep.
And then we have security is Sonny Melman, which is our beagle slash, I forget what the other part of him is. And then there's Silvio, who is the managing editor. And
right.
Every once in a while, you'll see a picture of him right next to me or looking over my keyboard because he always wants me to keep working. And then there's Isabella, who is another cat with one crumpled ear, but she still pulls off elegance. We have to do like a full audit. We think she's getting paid as a promotional consultant. We haven't actually seen any actual work from her. Just she puts in expense reports. So,
but still,
you know.
Yeah, like you said, you got to check this out. But again, you've created a persona for the company. You've created individual personas for the staff members. And then you've actually pulled together, he didn't make up Teal, James Glenn, and people like that.
No, no.
You pulled together legitimate writers who are accomplished in their own particular realms and have gotten them to contribute for a small fee to this publication.
Right.
And okay, so how did you choose the material?
A couple of things. When I did that event with them, I watched them do the reading, so I got exposed to all of their writing. And also, how did they react to me? How did they react to the public? Were they easy to work with? All that sort of stuff. And then that became the core of the invitation list.
Uh-huh.
And then who else did I know? You. And then there are a few other people that I thought this person I've been exposed to might have some interesting stuff. So I would go there. And I didn't get 100% acceptance. Some people turned me down flat because they didn't know what it was going to be. And one or two people, they are very careful. They're cultivating their career. They want only the best places. You can't hold that against them. That's fine. Maybe eventually they say, you know what? That looks like fun. And I want to do that as well. But I have to prove it. And then lastly, whenever I went to cons or anything, I would listen to the writers. Either I heard them on a panel or they would come up to the table where we were selling or whatever. And every once in a while, it would click. I think about a 75, maybe 80% success rate, maybe 70% success rate in inviting those few people and getting good work out of them.
And again, what was your yardstick for the material itself?
Okay, especially with this first issue, I was requesting, or I was telling, I would prefer, and I would choose stories that featured a female protagonist who shows her will, skill, or agency to confront some sort of horror. Didn't have to be, but the story would, it would work a little better for me if it was that. And you and I have talked about how much we love Pat Savage and people like that. And that's where that inspiration came from. And then I said it absolutely could not go above a soft R. As much as I respect splatterpunk and extreme horror and all that sort of stuff, I just get thrown out of the story. Within that, I could offer a certain amount of money plus an author profile, plus contributor's copy. And as we get further into promotion, I'll be promoting the authors involved in that. That's how I chose them, with one exception. It was someone that I had, you know, how you go on Twitter and I cultivate like a writing community. That's who I follow more than anything else. And there was somebody who just kept popping up and I thought she said interesting things. So I took a risk and she wound up giving a great story. So with a few exceptions, that worked really well. One came in, that fun story, great story. It was too violent and there are a lot of female prisoners and that kind of stuff. And out of the gate, I just couldn't do that. So I almost begged his forgiveness in declining. And there were two others that maybe a few more that I'm trying to be conservative here that were just, I was pretty clear. And they just didn't pay attention to the directions. So what are you gonna do?
It can be that sometimes people's styles just don't shift. It's just, they do what they do and that's what they know. It comes through that way. But right. Okay, so
you. But if you say soft R, hardest, and they open the story with the entire restaurant was covered in blood, they didn't listen to the assignment.
Or that's their... we didn't show you the people being decapitated and splattered and cut open.
They could make that argument, but
that's as soft as I could go. You know, I'm just saying that sometimes people's yardsticks are different. So you've really brought us quite a ways with quite a ways in this journey. Mm-hmm. From the initial inspiration and going back in time a little bit to enjoy that. You talk about my Wayback Machine. Yeah. And you brought us to this point of where you've collected together writers and material for this. Right. You've got a title for the series concept. You've got staff, which you've created. You've got all these elements.
I wound up with a pile of stories and I separated which ones would fit well for volume one and which one would fit volume two. And then I spread them out. I've talked about index cards so often that different ideas for a story. And then I organize them. Mm-hmm. The same thing with the stories. I read them until I was familiar with them. So that's a couple of times through. And then I put them spread them out on my dining room table and then figure out the order. And then I put them in a pile. And when I sent a contract, everybody got a contract. And then I sent a 5 or 6 question interview. So when that came back, I would print those up and I would have them so I could copy and paste what I needed. But so I put them in between the stories. So I would just go through one last edit and I would put the story in the file, do whatever the last edits are. Next page, I would figure out, I had to assign the different author profiles to the different interns based on the feel of the story and which one would work best with that story.
Chris Ryan, AKA Sybil.
Yeah, it was funny because I got very serious with myself about it. It was pretty funny. So then I would write in that voice, that profile, then go mm-hmm. edit the next story. So it came to be a big file. Done. The table, the title page, the indicia, the
table of contents from the publisher, the introduction from Dez, story, author, and the pop culture articles, like the panel discussion between you and Teal. Mike Rogers wrote about Mina Harkness from Dracula. Mm-hmm. His brother William Rogers wrote about Faye Ray. These are all in the first volume. So I put it all the way all through, and it's all done, and it's ready to go and get published.
Yeah.
Oh, I had hired this great artist. You saw the cover work. That's Juan Cruz Prats from Argentina. And he had done some interior work for me to help people easily. I had two skulls. One that was smoking, that's for fiction, and one that was wearing glasses and sitting on a book for nonfiction. I had all this all laid out, and I went to put it in onto Amazon as the first of the places that was going to publish it. Nope. They wouldn't take it that way.
Because
and it wasn't laid out to whatever. They started explaining it to me, and I said, oh, it's a foreign language to me. I had come up against the limit of my knowledge as far as publishing and all that's concerned. I had never tried something.
The technology of publishing, the actual physical arena. So
I had to go beyond myself. And I got somebody who was...
And I'm going to stop you there. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
Because we're almost at the cliff.
Oh, we're almost at the cliff.
I got somebody who...
He's accelerating towards the cliff.
She agreed to the layout, and she was capable of doing it. But then it entailed more work than she realized, and she had a whole business to run. She has a printing business, and she tried to get to it between the jobs. And it was like a month had passed, and she didn't really make as much headway as either of us wanted. So we agreed to toss it back to me. I'm a big fan of hers and a lot of stuff. I don't hold it against her. But there I was.
Standing there with this monolithic...
Hanging by a cliff,
yep,
with my dream, not knowing whether I was going to find a way to do this or whether I was going to have to talk to all these people that I had personally invited to do this project and say, I have failed you.
Wow.
And wow, that was the cliff I was hanging from.
Yes. Be with us next week for the next, which is really what we're going to do, because that's what we're going to end it here, folks. Let me just roll back just very quickly to put this under an umbrella. Many people will approach the creative experience, the creative life, whether you're a practicing professional or an aspiring one, and say, I want to write, and I'm just going to write my stories, and I'm going to send them out there to the world and see if somebody will print them. And that's one route to go. Another one is, I'm going to write my stories, and I'm going to publish them myself, and you'd be self-publisher, entrepreneurial, however you want to look at that. And then there are the moments when you decide, I really want this to be a business. And I want to not only be able to produce my own material, but I also want to be able to produce other people's material. And I want it to be on a very professional quality level,
yeah,
which is very different from, I'm just going to get my stuff out there. And God bless, as we tend to do, we tend to say, I respect this, I respect that. God bless people who, you know, really, what am I going to do? I'm just going to get my stuff out there. I just want to get the stuff out there. But there are levels. There's so many different levels in which you can do that. And you, in your particular case, decided to, because this is who you are, to do it on as professional level as humanly possible, solo.
So,
and I think with respect, Glorious, who is his wife, folks, you know, read that in the subtitles, his wife, does act at times as an editor for you. She will read the material, and sometimes...
She's the first reader. She's a supporter, a sounding board. She's not a harsh critic, which is why she's first. And then right, I go to other people who are harsher, but...
Who will beat you at the club, yeah. But yeah, for the sake of this particular interview, it is very much a solo enterprise in so many ways.
Mm.
And I think what we need to point out is, A, setting a bar for the project that you want, setting a quality level that you want to aspire towards, and that's necessary. Having a vision of what that property is supposed to look like, being able to negotiate with and communicate with other people as you're putting your project together, whether you're writing a graphic novel and you have to discuss things with your illustrators, or if you're writing an anthology and you're collecting work from other people as well, or you're just simply doing business with printers and distributors and things like that, being able to articulate what your vision is and being able to negotiate and dialogue with people is key. And that's something that you had to do. And then after all that, because you mentioned also contracts, so putting your word down or what the expectations are in writing,
making sure you cover the legal,
theoretically and physically, can be on the same page about what the expectations are. Because when you're talking money and you're talking properties, intellectual properties and things like that, you've got to be as precise as possible.
Oh, yeah. And I wanted to make sure. So I did a lot of research and I looked a lot of contract templates. And ironically, in the middle of that, I got a contract, potential contract, for a book of poetry that I did. And the contract was 2 sentences long. And it didn't protect me from anything.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, I'm not going to be there.
You're not going to be that person. Yeah.
And if people are comfortable with that, God bless them. Yeah. Maybe these guys are the coolest, most honest people in the world. But I was going to have that, make sure everybody was protected.
So again, covering your bases from a business standpoint, as well as from a creative and ethical standpoint, is key. And now, with the body of work collected and ready to go into the printing process, whether it's digital or otherwise, to hit a wall.
Oh, yeah.
What do you do when you hit that wall? And that's what we will find out next week.
Yeah. And so hopefully this is inspiring people that have whatever that dream is to say, all right, let's see how this turns out. But it hopefully gives you some feel that I can find a way to do what I want to do.
It can be done.
And do it well.
But take notes. Take notes. Don't just figure, okay, I'll remember all this stuff. Because no, that's not how it works. That's not how it works at all.
Do you remember Jonathan Livingston Seagull?
The book, the movie, the song. Okay, yes.
So the book, there was a book that author wrote afterwards called Illusions, Reflections of a Reluctant Messiah. And there was some kind of book that whenever you opened it up, there would be a sentence there that would be exactly what you needed to read. And I was in high school when I first read this. And there was one, you open the book and there was one piece of wisdom there. And it said, you can get, or you can do, or achieve anything you want in life. You may have to work for it, however. And that has inspired me in these darkest moments. As I'm hanging from this cliff, holding this sacred volume that has been created, that is a dream of my dream, and trying not to fall to my doom, those were the words that sustained me, and hopefully they'll sustain you into our next episode.
That's right. So it's been great hanging with you, Indiana Ryan. And folks, take care, everybody. Live long and prosper. Be here next week for the next thrilling chapter in the making of Soul Screen.
In the meantime, if they want to go to Amazon and pick some copies up, that's cool with me too.
You do that. There'll be a link in the comment section for you to do that.
There you go.
Chris, be well.
Peace, sir. All right.